Several weeks ago at the Dalreda Church of Christ, we started a class called Burnout and Renewal. And this is an effort to continue that study, although we're in a different situation and confined to our homes for the most part. I thought it might be helpful. Certainly it will be for me, and hopefully it'll be helpful for you for us to continue this class together. So we're going to take another lesson today, and we'll try to do this each week, and continue this study on burnout and renewal. So there will be an attached discussion sheet that you can download after you listen to this lesson, and perhaps you and your family or friends can continue the study on your own. This lesson today is from the story of Elijah in 1 Kings chapters 17, 18, and the beginning of chapter 19. And we're going to examine Elijah's burnout as sort of a case study, if you will, of what burnout sometimes looks like, in an attempt to learn some things about it for ourselves. Elijah was, as you know, a prophet of God during the reign of a king named Ahab, who was king of Israel. And Ahab was the seventh king of Israel. He reigned for 22 years, according to 1 Kings 16, verse 28. He made some pretty shrewd foreign policy decisions that benefited God's people, but his religious policies were pretty disastrous to God's people. And as far as kings go, Ahab receives the distinction, if you will, of doing more evil in the sight of the Lord than all who were before him, 1 Kings chapter 16, verse 30. That's pretty bad. If you read through the book of 1 Kings, you're going to see a lot of very wicked kings in Israel. And if Ahab was the worst one that they had, that's saying something. We're also told in verse 33 that Ahab did more to provoke the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger than all the kings of Israel who were before him. We're told that he took a wife, Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, who served Baal. She served these false gods, Baal and Asherah. She had a total of 850 prophets of these false gods who not only stood at her side, but ate at her dinner table. In other words, she was their patron. She provided for them, according to 1 Kings chapter 18, verse 19. And later in chapter 18, verse 4, we find out that she cut off, which probably means killed, the prophets of the Lord. So, to say that Elijah began his service to the Lord during a dangerous and challenging time would be a tremendous understatement. They were technically still God's people, but Israel had really never been further away from God than they were now. And their kings and queens were largely to blame for this spiritual shift. So it's in this hostile environment that God basically says to Elijah, I want you to go tell this wicked king that there's not going to be any moisture in the land. No dew, no rain, no nothing for the next few years. Tell him that it's going to be dry, in fact, until you say differently. That's from 1 Kings chapter 17, verse 1. Now, God knew that this particular message, especially when it proved to be true, was going to put Elijah in danger. So the very next thing that we read in 1 Kings chapter 17, verses 2 through 4, is that the word of the Lord came to Elijah and said, depart from here and turn eastward and hide yourself by the brook Cherith, which is east of the Jordan. You shall drink from the brook, and I have commanded the ravens to feed you there. Now, don't you find it interesting that God sends Elijah into complete isolation? We might even say this is God's way of quarantining Elijah in the most extreme way possible. In fact, his only social contact seems to have been with ravens, who aren't great conversationalists from what I hear. We might ask the question, why would God do this? I really don't know. We do know that there were 7,000 others who were faithful to God at this time who had not bowed the knee to Baal or kissed his ring, according to 1 Kings 19, verse 18. But for whatever reason, God does not send Elijah to any of those 7,000 people. He isolates him. And keep in mind that when God does send Elijah to live with someone else during this drought and famine, the person he chooses is not even an Israelite. 1 Kings chapter 17, beginning in verse 9. So, when the brook dries up, God does send Elijah to live with a widow who lives in a place called Zarephath, which is in Sidon. It's not Israel. And when Elijah meets this woman, she and her son are literally at death's door. They have one meal left, and then according to her words, they're just going to die. 1 Kings chapter 17, verse 12. So evidently this drought, this famine, has been going on long enough to have had a serious effect on the economy here. And Elijah's words to her are very interesting here, and they're an indication of his faith in this situation. The first three words he says to her are, "Do not fear." And I think it's interesting that Elijah says this to her. I think it's a testament to his spiritual stability at this point in the story. He informs her that the Lord is going to provide for her and for her son until this drought is over. Thankfully, she has the faith and the trust to do what Elijah says, and the Lord does indeed provide for her. After many days, however, her son gets sick and he dies. And she understandably correlates this death of her son with the appearance of Elijah. And she says in verse 18, "What have you against me, O man of God? You have come to me to bring my sin to remembrance and to cause the death of my son." So she's sort of accusing Elijah of having something to do with the death of her son. And what is Elijah's response? Well, again, his spiritual stability, his faith is strong. He takes this woman's son into the upper chamber, into his room. He lays him on his bed. He prays fervently that God would bring the life back into this child, and he does. Now I want you to pause for a moment and realize something. Elijah's prayer just brought someone back from the dead. He did not know that this was going to work when he took this child upstairs and laid him down, but he believed that it would work, and it did. So as we can continue to see here, Elijah has a strong faith, doesn't he? Now we see in chapter 18, as we move into another section of this story, that after many days, the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year of this drought or famine, saying, "Go, show yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain upon the earth." Now keep in mind, God is asking Elijah to trust him here in a very real way. He's asking him to show his face to a wicked king during a time, not after a time, but during a time when the land of Israel has been subject to a three-year drought and famine. And the famine, according to verse 2, is severe at this point. This is a scary assignment, and Elijah obeys, according to verse 2. So evidently, Elijah's faith has not only survived this drought and famine, but it has thrived. It has grown. He is still willing to be God's prophet, even in the face of what is probably the equivalent of a starving animal. So as Elijah is traveling toward Ahab, Ahab has sent out a man named Obadiah, who was over the household and who feared the Lord greatly, verse 3. He has tasked Obadiah with searching the land to find some grass so that they could feed their horses and mules and maybe they won't all die. So Obadiah goes one way by himself, and Ahab goes the other way by himself, and they start looking for grass. And as luck would have it, or probably more likely as God would have it, Elijah meets Obadiah on the way. And I would like to read their conversation as it's found in the English Standard Version of 1 Kings chapter 18, beginning in verse 7. "As Obadiah was on the way, behold, Elijah met him, and Obadiah recognized him and fell on his face and said, 'Is it you, my lord Elijah?' And he answered him, 'It is I. Go tell your lord, behold, Elijah is here.' And he said, 'How have I sinned that you would give your servant into the hand of Ahab to kill me? As the Lord your God lives, there is no nation or kingdom where my lord has not sent to seek you.' And when they would say, 'He's not here,' He would take an oath of the kingdom or nation that they had not found you. And now you say, go tell your Lord, behold, Elijah is here. And as soon as I have gone from you, the Spirit of the Lord will carry you, I know not where. And so when I have come and tell Ahab that he cannot find you, he will kill me. Although I, your servant, have feared the Lord from my youth. Has it not been told, my Lord, what I did when Jezebel killed the prophets of the Lord, how I hid 100 men of the Lord's prophets by 50s in a cave and fed them with bread and water? And now you say, go tell your Lord, behold, Elijah is here. He will kill me. So Obadiah is not excited about going to get Ahab, but Elijah convinces him to do this. And so Obadiah goes to get Ahab. Ahab shows up and quickly reveals how he feels about Elijah. He says in verse 17, is it you, you troubler of Israel? In other words, this is all your fault, Elijah. Elijah could have been scared upon hearing those words from the most powerful man in the nation, but his answer exhibits bold and fearless faith. And not only that, but a determination to bring God's people, all of them, back into a right relationship with God. Elijah is going big here. Read with me verses 18 and 19 of this same chapter. He answered, I have not troubled Israel, but you have in your father's house, because you have abandoned the commandments of the Lord and followed the Baals. Now therefore, send and gather all Israel to me at Mount Carmel, and the 450 prophets of Baal, and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. So what we have coming up next in this chapter, and I'm sure you're familiar with it, is where Elijah has his famous showdown slash smackdown with the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel. He's not only courageous and fearless in his faith during this exhibition, but he even shows a sense of humor, as we see in verse number 27. And remember, Elijah is literally, physically, in a human way of thinking, by himself during all of this. If you will bear with me, I want to read this account because it's fascinating and it's important to our lesson today regarding Elijah's burnout. Let's read beginning in verse 20 down through verse number 40 and see what happens in this amazing chapter. So Ahab sent to all the people of Israel and gathered the prophets together at Mount Carmel. And Elijah came near to all the people and said, how long will you go limping between two different opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him. And the people did not answer him a word. Then Elijah said to the people, I, even I only, am left a prophet of the Lord, but Baal's prophets are 450 men. Let two bulls be given to us, and let them choose one bull for themselves and cut it in pieces and lay it on the wood, but put no fire to it. And I will prepare the other bull and lay it on the wood and put no fire to it. And you call upon the name of your God, and I will call upon the name of the Lord, and the God who answers by fire, he is God. So there's the setup. That's the challenge. That's the contest, if you will. And all the people answered, it is well spoken. Verse number 25, then Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, choose for yourselves one bull and prepare it first, for you are many, and call upon the name of your God, but put no fire to it. And they took the bull that was given them, and they prepared it and called upon the name of Baal from morning until noon, saying, O Baal, answer us. But there was no voice, and no one answered. And they limped around the altar that they had made. And at noon, Elijah mocked them, saying, cry aloud. Here's that sense of humor. For he is a god. Either he is musing, or he is relieving himself, or he's on a journey, or perhaps he is asleep and must be awakened. Elijah's having fun with this, you can tell. And they cried aloud and cut themselves after their custom with swords and lances until the blood gushed out upon them. And as midday passed, they raved on until the time of the offering of the oblation, but there was no voice, no one answered, no one paid attention. Elijah just lets them go on and on and on, hour after hour after hour, trying to get a false idol to do something for them, and it never happens. Then we get to verse 30. Then Elijah said to all the people, come near to me. And by this time, I'm sure they're ready to see something besides this. And all the people came near to him, and he repaired the altar of the Lord that had been thrown down. Elijah took 12 stones, according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord came, saying, Israel shall be your name. And with the stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord. And he made a trench about the altar, as great as would contain 2 seahs of seed. A seah was about 7 quarts, or 7.3 liters. And he put the wood in order, and cut the bull in pieces, and laid it on the wood. And he said, fill 4 jars with water, and pour it on the burnt offering and on the wood. And he said, do it a second time. And they did it a second time. And he said, do it a third time. And they did it a third time. And the water ran around the altar and filled the trench also with water. And at the time of the offering of the oblation, Elijah the prophet came near and said, O Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known this day that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and that I have done all these things at your word. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, that this people may know that you, O Lord, are God, and that you have turned their hearts back. A simple prayer. Verse 38. Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and said, the Lord, he is God, the Lord, he is God. And Elijah said to them, seize the prophets of Baal. Let not one of them escape. And they seized them. And Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and slaughtered them there. What would you call this? Would you say that this event was a success from Elijah's perspective? How much of a success was it? I mean, we might say, if we were comparing Elijah to a modern day preacher, that his sermon, if you will, caused every person in the auditorium to come forward and to righteously execute 450 prophets of Baal. It was an amazing victory, tremendous triumph of God's will and God's power. And in verses 41 through 46, Elijah receives the message from God that he is sending rain back to the land. Elijah tells Ahab, prepare your chariot and go down, lest the rain stop you, verse 44. And then we're told in verse 46 that the hand of the Lord was on Elijah, and he gathered up his garment and ran before Ahab to the entrance of Jezreel. This is interesting here. Several commentators agree that Elijah in this instance is being given supernatural strength and speed, and actually outruns Ahab's chariot back to Jezreel. Imagine. Just imagine the sight of Elijah the prophet gathering up his robe and running faster than a horse-drawn chariot. Elijah is literally a superhero of faith right now, isn't he? Any sign of burnout in Elijah's life? Are there any clues that might lead us to think that Elijah is just barely hanging on, spiritually speaking? On the contrary, he seems to be literally living on the spiritual mountaintop, doesn't he? And that's why what happens next is definitely not what Elijah expected. In fact, it might be that disparity between his expectation and what actually happened that led to his rather unexpected response. But let's pause at this moment and maybe speculate just a little bit on what Elijah probably expected to happen at this point in this account. I mean, consider this. Elijah has just disposed of 450 false prophets. He just got the full attention and presumably the loyalty of the people turned back to God. He seemingly has convinced the most wicked king in Israel's history to start listening to him. What do you think he anticipated when he got back to the king's palace? When he watched Ahab go inside to bring Jezebel up to speed on what just happened? Wouldn't it be reasonable to think that Elijah is expecting some kind of house cleaning in Israel. That he's expecting Ahab to redirect his focus, his influence back towards God and away from idolatry. That he's expecting Jezebel to finally humble herself and see the true power of God and the true impotence of her false gods. That he is anticipating a full return and reconciliation of God's people. In fact, it would not be unreasonable to think that Elijah is anticipating a new phase of his own prophetic work at this point. One that perhaps involves more social interaction and less hiding and isolation. I mean, think about it. After all, it's been 3 years, and everything has led up to this point. And the events of chapter 18 were undoubtedly, in Elijah's mind, the turning point for God's people, right? Turns out that's not right. We read in verses 1 and 2 that that's not what happened. Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. Then, instead of humbling herself, Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, "So may the gods do to me and more also if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by this time tomorrow." In other words, you've got 24 hours to live and I'm going to kill you. Now, let's think about a couple things. Whether or not Jezebel would or could have carried out this threat is irrelevant. Whether or not God would have protected Elijah from her evil plan is irrelevant. Because we don't see how any of those scenarios would have played out. Because this threat alone has a very unexpected and immediate and crushing impact on Elijah. Regardless of how we might think as we sit in the comfort of our own home and say, "Why didn't you do this, Elijah?" Regardless of what we might think he should have done, this is how he actually did respond. Let me read from 1 Kings chapter 19, beginning in verse 3. "Then he was afraid." Let's pause there. The man who just a couple chapters ago told the widow of Zarephath, "Do not fear," because he had such strong faith. Now he himself is afraid. Then what comes next? After the fear sets in, he arose and ran for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree. And he asked that he might die, saying, "It is enough. Now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am no better than my fathers." And he lay down and slept under a broom tree. Now, we could call this a number of things, I suppose. We could call it discouragement. We could call it depression. We could call it defeat. But could we also, by its very definition, call it burnout? Remember the definition that we talked about a couple weeks ago. Burnout is the extinction of motivation or incentive, especially when one's devotion to a cause or a relationship fails to produce the desired results. And isn't that exactly what has happened in Elijah's mind? All of his motivation, all of his incentive has dried up immediately, suddenly. Because his devotion to the cause is not producing the desired results. Next week, we're going to notice God's response to this burnout. But for now, let's sit with it and observe a few things that might prove helpful to us as Christians. Number one, isolation can be viewed in two basic ways, probably more than two, but at least two basic ways. And each of these basic approaches towards isolation can completely and will completely shape our mindset. The first approach that we can have to isolation is deprivation. In other words, we can focus on all of the things that we are being deprived of. All of the things that we're missing out on, all the things we used to have that we no longer have. We can focus on it in that regard. We can feel deprived. We can be discontent. Or we can focus with an attitude of preparation. Not deprivation, but preparation. How can I take this isolation and better prepare myself? What are some things that I need to work on? What are some things that I might have been missing in my own life that this shutdown, this isolated time in my life might reveal? Those will create very different mindsets and very different courses of action in a person's life. And we see that in this story, don't we? That Elijah approached his isolation with an attitude of preparation, and it strengthened his faith. So he did that correctly. But that brings us to our second observation in this lesson, that really there is no amount of faith or service or devotion to God that can serve as a foolproof firewall for burnout. I mean, we saw Elijah's faith. It was genuine. It was strong, even in the face of adversity. If this can happen to Elijah in the spiritual condition that he was in, then it can happen to any of us. Number three, burnout, though we often have it occur in our life gradually over time, it can also sneak up on us. It can manifest itself suddenly, immediately, unexpectedly. So the lesson there might be that if we know that and anticipate that we might be able to spare ourselves from some of those experiences of burnout. Number four, sometimes our own expectations, even if those expectations are good, and even if they come from a passionate desire to see other people turn to God, sometimes our own expectations can set us up for burnout. What we think should happen when that doesn't happen, when what we think should happen doesn't happen, burnout is knocking on the door, isn't it? I had really not planned on making any application of this story to our current situation in the world right now with what we're facing. I had this lesson planned before any of this happened. But I think there are a couple suggestions that I would be remiss if I didn't point out based on this lesson, and you might know of more. But I thought of at least two things that I think we need to take from this right now in the midst of this situation that we face. The first of those things is this. As Christians, as God's people, we need to be very careful about how we anticipate things working out, especially during situations like the one we find ourselves in now. We may think to ourselves, well, this is all going to be fine, or this is all going to be awful, or this is going to work out this way, or the doctor in charge says this, or the president says this, or et cetera, et cetera. Even when God, and Elijah saw this, even if God seems to be doing something very specific in our lives or through our lives or around us, we may not have the full picture. See, God might have very different plans. Elijah knew exactly what God wanted him to do, and he still seems to have had a different outcome in mind than the one God had ultimately intended. So the bottom line is this for Christians. We don't know exactly what God is going to do in this situation, through this situation that we face today. We need to be very careful not to assume that we know His plan. We're told in Proverbs 16, verse 9, the heart of a man plans his way, but the Lord establishes his steps. And don't we remember that passage from that great book of James, chapter 4? I want to read this from, this is not a translation, this is a paraphrase of the Bible called The Message, and I don't typically study from it, but I like the way The Message puts this. In James chapter 4, verses 13 through 17, listen to it in this way. And now I have a word for you who brashly announce, today, at the latest, tomorrow, we're off to such and such a city for the year. We're going to start a business and make a lot of money. You don't know the first thing about tomorrow. You're nothing but a wisp of fog catching a brief bit of sun before disappearing. Instead, make it a habit to say, if the Master wills it, and we're still alive, we'll do this or that. As it is, you are full of your grandiose selves. All such vaunting self-importance is evil. In fact, if you know the right thing to do and don't do it, that for you is evil. The second thing that I think we can learn from this in our current situation is that our isolation, that we probably never would have chosen for ourselves, is an opportunity that we will shape through our approach towards it. If we approach this time of isolation as a deprivation, and we focus on all the things we miss and all the things we wish we could do and all the things we're missing out on, then our lives will be shaped by that attitude. And it will not be a shaping that brings us more into the mold of the image of God. If, however, we approach this time of isolation as preparation, we will be shaped differently. If we ask the Lord, what do you want from me during this time? What can I do differently? How can I better myself? How can I build my faith and grow in love and grow in kindness toward others? If we approach it in that way, we will be shaped very differently. Now, I didn't say it'd be easy or painless, but it will be for our good, Romans 8:28, and it will bring us more into the mold and image of our God. You might be able to think of a few more applications or lessons from this story that would be very applicable to our situation. I would encourage you to study these chapters on your own or with your family. Ask God to reveal to you whatever truth you might need to hear today. Next week, we'll take a closer look at how God responded to Elijah's burnout. We might be surprised by what we find, but until then, may God bless you. Let's close our time together with a prayer. Holy Father, these are strange times that we live in, and we know as we look into your word, we are reminded that your people have always faced difficult situations. You have always challenged them and expected them to live out a life of faith in dangerous and hostile and uncertain times. We're reminded by the story of your servant Elijah that sometimes things don't go the way that we thought that they would, and we are still required to lean on you and turn to you. And Lord, even when we do that, sometimes we find ourselves crippled by the kind of burnout and discouragement and depression that Elijah faced in this story. We ask for your help. We humbly pray that you will be with us during this dark hour, that it will become brighter because of our approach towards it and our dependence upon you. Bless everyone that hears this message with a measure of grace and mercy and wisdom as we continue to try to serve you better. In the name of your precious Son, we pray. Amen. May God bless you.